GMN are just a normalization of these matrix elements, and then G to make them also normal. Okay. And so yesterday we discussed that these Reich translation actually keep most indices invariant, and so the Reich translation have invariant subspaces and split into sub-representations. And so the only thing which what changes is the last index. And so this gives you basically one VG sub-representation for every J, but for every index M here. And so I mentioned already yesterday that there's of course also the left translations. So you can do the same game with the left translations. And apply it, say, to these matrix elements D, J, M, N. And so this was defined as left multiplication with the inverse. So you will get, if I write that at once, M, N, Q, H minus 1, D, J, Q, N, G. So you can conclude that also the left translations leave a certain space invariant, and this time it's basically labeled by the right magnetic index, as one could guess. H minus 1. But you multiply actually with H minus 1, and there's also a bit of change here in the indices, because here you might you sum over the first index, here you sum over this index, and in fact this tells you that you have sub-representations. And this sub-representation is called the conjugated, let me, contra-gradient representation to the J, to VJ. Let me define it in a second. So this means contra-gradient or dual representation to VJ. And so this is defined as so if you have a representation DJ MN G, then DJ star MNG, so the matrix elements of the contragradient representations are defined to be G the inverse. And here you take the transpose.
I'm a little confused because when we have like J equals 1, we basically have the adjoint representation. And we have the adjoint representation. And we know the adjoint representation is irreducible.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we have, like, how can we, because are we reducing the representation into two representations?
No, so this is, So this is really, so for spin one, you get a spin one contragradient representation. But in fact, so let me just finish this here. It's actually it's unitary equivalent to the spin one representation. So that's why you don't care. But every choice, you know, every change of basis gives you technically a different representation because you change your representation labels. And so as an exercise, or in reading the script, you can check that the unitary transformation is given by a certain matrix. And this matrix is actually epsilon minus 2t2. And so there's so this is actually also a unitary matrix because it's SU2. It happens to be also in the group SU2. And so DJ star okay, apparently, okay. I hope I'm not wrong. DJ star MN G will be DJ MNG. DJ MM prime DJ so minus one M. So something like this holds modulo minus one. Modulo the choice of minus one, but it might actually not matter. At least it doesn't happen in the, it doesn't matter in the J equal 1/2 representation. so actually that's why you might not be very, very much aware of this contragradient representation, but it exists. And actually in computation, one can make an easy mistake in missing these epsilons. So be a bit careful if one computes with these. and indeed for for a unitary representation, this inverse is equal to, so this would be the inverse matrix also. So this is equal to the joint. The joint is equal to transposition and complex conjugated. So you transpose again and you complex conjugate. So the dual representation in this case for unitary representation is just the complex conjugated representation. Okay, and so that's just the definition, and it happens that this action is really the contragradient representation. And in fact, as you see, it just, you know, the different ways in which right and left translations act. And so from these definitions, we see that L2G actually decomposes into a direct sum over J labels, and then you have a VJ star. So that's a contragradient representation, tensor VJ. And so this gives you the correct result because the dimension of these 2J plus 1. So indeed, here you get a 1VJ subrepresentation for every magnetic index here. So you get a 2J plus 1 VJ's representation subspaces. and so this is basically kind of a spin network decomposition of your Hilbert space. OK. Thank you. That's what I... Basically, what is this VJ star? It's unitary equivalent. VJ. Okay. So we have seen that the right translations act leave all these subspaces invariant. And so let's look at the infinitesimal right translations, which are defined to be the left invariant derivatives. And we know that these are basically the fluxes. And so how does a flux act on a spin network state of one edge? So this was defined to be IH bar, this left invariant derivative, JMN. And so this was the derivative of the Reich translation. And so we know how the Reich translation acts. So I'm just writing here. Already the result and the derivative in front of the expression, which actually contains the parameter which is derived. So to be derived. So here you just apply a right translation and take the derivative of this exponential of this group element here. And doing that, you will actually just obtain, or it's basically a definition of how you get a Lie algebra representation from a Lie group representation. You take the derivative of these exponentiated group elements. And so that, in fact, gives you the J representation of your Lie algebra. And for this, you know, the same thing applies that the action leaves invariant all these subspaces. And this subspace just happens to be the angular momentum algebra. And so this will give you a representation of your angular momentum algebra, which is given by these T's. You could call them also J's. And so we already basically are near this maximal diagonalization of our momentum subalgebra. We can choose, for instance, T3, this is a standard choice to be diagonal. And indeed, that's typically also happening in our choice, because sigma typically is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. And so T3 will be diagonal in this case. And then there's another operator which typically is diagonal, and that's the Casimir. And if you know that in the angular momentum case, it's actually J squared. It's a square or the sum of the squares of your components. And so this brings us actually to the length operator, which I will first define abstractly, and then I will actually tell you why this is the length operator of a curve dual to actually gamma, so this gamma star, which we introduced at some point. So let's define a funny operator called L squared with a hat, L squared, E star. And let's apply to our basis. And so this is defined to be the sum of the flux algebra components . And so now I'm basically in a finite dimensional situation. I have these operators leaving finite dimensional subspaces invariant. So I can safely kind of multiply matrices. So there's no difficulty in defining the square of an operator. And so we just apply two times what we had previously. And so we get the product of these representation matrices of the Lie algebra elements. And okay, now I'm basically telling you what you would know if you just think of these as really angular momentum operators, JK in a J representation. That's what they eventually are. And but if you don't know, so you have to consider basically this operator. Let's call it Qn. So Qn are basically the free indices, and that's defined to be the sum over, call it Pk. Yeah, so the sum over k and also P, which is implicit there in the matrix product. Pn Tk. And so you can check that this operator commutes with all elements, so all basis elements of your Lie algebra basis. So Qn gives the matrix elements of this operator Cj in your spin network basis, and it only acts on this right index. I could write hats, but now it's really matrix. We work with explicit expressions in a given basis. So depends on whether you want to write hats or not. And so the commutator is zero. And so this technically is called an intertwiner. Because it intertwines with a representation dj here. And so then you have to apply the Schur's lemma. And this tells you if you have this such an intertwiner, which intertwines with an irreducible representation, this operator is either zero or it's equal to some multiple of the identity operator. And so this is Schur's lemma, which is a basic result of group theory. If, you know, it's indeed, if you haven't seen it, it's actually proven in the script, but I'm not sure how much pages I gave you of the script, but it'll be there. So you could use that, and then you only have to determine lambda, and lambda follows also from this property and the representation properties of your Lie algebra, and everything goes exactly the same if you have ever derived it, how you derive representation spaces for the angular momentum. So the argument is exactly the same. You actually, you know, introduce raising and lowering operators and conclude that you get a finite dimensional Hilbert space because they have to annihilate at you have some maximal vectors and some minimal vectors and so on. And then you conclude that from this discussion, you can also conclude that this Casimir is given by minus j, j plus 1. And so this is actually the well-known Casimir of the angular momentum algebra. Sometimes it's also called a Laplacian because this Casimir gives you the Laplacian on the group manifold. Okay. So this tells you that lambda, this L squared, is diagonal in our, so that the spin network basis so we are actually in this case, and so it's the identity operator on all these subspaces, and in any case it leaves these subspaces invariant, so it's really diagonal in this basis, and the eigenvalues are given by minus j, j plus 1. And if you restore units, you actually find for the length operator, so for the square root, I define this. So then you take the square root of this operator, and you can take the square root of this operator. Of course, now I have the sign issue. Minus, so I had this, yeah. So the value of the Casimir is minus, and I have a minus here, so lambda squared has a positive spectrum. And so once you are diagonal, you can easily take the square root by taking the square root of your eigenvalues. restoring units, you get h bar, then this is I introduce a kappa 3D, and so this is Planck length 3D, and so kappa 3D would be a constant whose value we don't know because we do 3D stuff and we can't do really experiments in 3D, otherwise I could tell you a number, but so it's actually the only thing which you know is you can conclude about the units, and so this is basically the action that you write and that the constant which you write in front of your action, and from determining the units of this action, you can conclude what this what these units are, and these happen to be length divided by action. And so if you multiply with Planck constants, which has the units of an action, you get a length. And so this is actually called the 3D Planck length. And since kappa doesn't really have a value like g and 4D, this also doesn't really have a value in numbers. But in 4D, of course, you get a similar result for the area. Of course, you just get j plus 1 and not the square root. I hope, if I remember correctly. And then you get the 4D Planck length in front of this. And then in addition, you get a funny parameter called the Barbero-Emisi parameter. Yes?
So why does this have to be the Planck length? Like, why can't the scale of the quantum gravity be much larger distances? Can't we just put any number there that we want?
So if you would have, no, so all these things come really, if you would have always worked with units, then you would have gotten this result. And so indeed, it's always a question, you know, to make up. Typically, what always happens is that if you look for a result, then, you know, what turns up as a constant in front will be a combination of constants, which has the right units. And typically, there's not so many combinations you can do if you're really fundamental. So indeed, the Planck length is the only combination of the fundamental units you know, which you can form, so that it has a dimension of a length.
I guess, like, why aren't there any other fundamental units that we don't know yet? You know?
That could happen, but we don't know yet. So we so but then you need to quantize something in addition, you know. So as long as you're dealing only with this set of series, it's a bit hard to include some unknown effects. And so here in 3D, it's a bit it's a bit subtle that anyway, these are all kind of just formal constants that you include, because we can't go and measure this constant in an experiment in 3D. But in principle, you know, assume we could do that, that would determine your kappa in 3D. And so we see that so this actually generalizes. So you can, maybe there's even a tutorial that you compute the area spectrum. But actually, I still have to tell you that, or convince you that this is really the length operator. but in general, it's the case that spatial geometric operators have a discrete spectrum. Okay. And so indeed, in 4D, there's this unknown constant, the Barbero-Emisi parameter, which comes in, and which typically is assumed, however, to be of order 1. and this could have been concluded basically from the fact that we do quantization on SU2, and SU2 is a compact manifold, and all these spatial geometric operators are derivative operators on the spatial manifold. And so this is very similar to quantizing a particle on a circle, where you would get also discrete spectrum for the momentum of this particle. And so why is this the length operator? So let's consider the length of a curve gamma star. And so this would be defined as taking gamma star, the tangent vector to this curve, taking the square of this, b So QAB is my metric on the spatial manifold. Takes the square root, you integrate over this curve, gamma star. And so you rewrite this two metric as a pullback of your triads. So these k's really go from 1 to 3. And the spatial indices really go from 1 to 2. And so we have these, and here you have the same thing. And so you get this expression, and eventually you just want to have not the square root of the square of these, but you actually want to have the square of the fluxes. And so what you do is to chop up this curve into many little pieces. So we do this. And approximately we get a sum. Square root. So we consider now one edge this curve gamma star, and so here we have these little pieces E star and so now I have the square root of the sum of these integrals. Yeah.
Can I ask you again, why is this possible to do? Like just changing the integral with the square root? You're assuming the curve to be small?
Yeah, so all these curves are supposed to be small. And
what do you mean by small? Because in terms of length.
Yeah, there's no meaning, so it's a good question. but for, you know, so for small, you mean it's meant to be some auxiliary smallness. But indeed, it turns out that small, you can specify that because it will depend on your quantum state. And so what it will mean in the end is that actually, your quantum state, you know, will have edges which crosses this curve. So you have to make this depending on your quantum state, and that happens quite often, which is given on a certain graph, and this graph can be very fine. But given that, you have to make the smallness so fine so that in every, so that it's at most one crossing. Per piece. So this defines you kind of a quantum state adapted smallness. So technically, sometimes you call that a state dependent regularization. It's basically that indeed, you know, so it's an important question, but indeed the state gives you a notion of smallness or of how much you need to go with your kind of discrete approximation. And so you can always make it as small as a given state. And if your state is very fine, you have to go very fine. OK. And so indeed, these arguments then would apply to this kind of situation that you choose your subdivision such that only one of your spin network edges, which we haven't introduced yet, causes one piece. And so you do a lot of these things in approximating square roots of sums with sums of square roots and so on. And get finally to the square of your flux operators, to the square root of the sum. So here you actually approximated this one integral by two integrals to get the so one integral of a square you approximated by the square of two, by the product of two integrals. And so it's basically this situation that I've drawn here. So you have your spin network edges in blue, say, and then you have your dual edge. And so if this has a label J, then this means that modulo units, this has a length of J, J plus one. And so to get the total length of your curve, you would have to add up all these pieces. And so this will be a spin network vertex, which we actually will need in the next subject, which where we really introduce more of a graph than just one edge. But so this is motivates that this flux operator is really a length. And it's basically the length of a basic curve, which is dual to a spin network edge. And it has a discrete spectrum. And so in 2D and 3 plus 1, you get it for the area. You get the same result modulo that there's a gamma appearing this Barbero-Emisi parameter. Okay. And so technically, I gave you a representation which avoids lots of technical definitions. And these technical definitions are there to define the theory in the continuum. So actually, the claim is that we actually never really discretize, but we could have done the discussion, in principle, the entire discussion with an arbitrary edge, and so the with arbitrary representations of this algebra on arbitrary edges and arbitrary dual edges. And however, to do that, we would have had to introduce this concept of cylindrical consistency. And so indeed, you can ask what happens if I have my if I want to talk about an edge which I have declared to be an edge. And so in this Ashtika-Lewandowski vacuum, what you do if you say I want to declare this to be an edge, you say I can always basically enlarge a given discretization to a finite discretization by including arbitrary edges, you know, whatever. So there's a certain condition, like here, if you do this, you have to introduce this, and so on. And what you have to do is to write on all these new edges, they're all in the state j equal to zero. And so then the magnetic numbers can only be zero. So this they are put into a unique state. And so this defines you basically an embedding. So this can be something like j equal to 1 and m and n equal to minus 1. This defines an embedding on the Hilbert space of the Hilbert space based on one edge into a larger Hilbert space, which basically includes all these edges, and which will be given as a tensor product of all these L2Gs associated to every edge here. And so you might ask, how do I get out of this j equal to 0 state? And so we have seen that the derivatives, the fluxes, act as derivatives, and they just give you 0 on these states, on these edges. So it's actually the holonomies. They change the spin labels. And so the holonomies, in a sense, they act as creation operators and in principle also as annihilation operators in your Hilbert space. and they would change this. So that answers you, if you have any holonomy H gamma, you know, then you can always apply that for any curve gamma. And so this will be basically H gamma times 1, the state based on this curve phi gamma g or h, maybe this h gamma, which is a group element, times 1. And so indeed, you can convince yourself that the state, the constant state in the group, in the holonomy basis, corresponds to the j equal to 0, m equal to 0, n equal to 0 state in the spin basis. Yeah.
So in this case, for this type of state, we will have like 0 length edge.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that have a physical meaning? Because
it has a.
So my question is kind of oriented towards what we did yesterday in the tutorial, where mm-hmm. we considered the area operator.
Mm-hmm.
So that the area operator has non-zero eigenvalue.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it mean to have a state that has non-zero area, but its edges are basically of zero length?
State which has non-zero, but we have zero length. I think then this area operator should be also zero.
We show that all the eigenvalues.
no, if you apply the area operator to, depending on the ordering, but so you might have taken a weird ordering. But if you apply it to this state, you should get 0. Because
yeah,
it.
We just consider spin one half and spin one,
okay.
Spin zero.
Yeah. Yeah. okay. So that's a. General idea. and so for the Ashtekar-Lewandowski vacuum, these j equal to 0 states or c equal constant are quite important to make it into a continuum Hilbert space. So every discrete spin network, so even having just one edge, you could embed it into the continuum Hilbert space, but just saying if I want to know it on a finite discretization, I can always put it into finite discretization by putting everywhere j equal to 0. okay. So that. Closes this discussion on one edge, and now we go to one triangle. Now we go to arbitrary spin networks, and so this will be motivated by solving the Gauss constraints. And so, since I think because of time, I will tell you just some introductory remarks on how to solve in general constraints. So how we will do it is that in principle the Gauss constraints, which I forgot how they look like, but they look quite complicated. So it was that these Gauss constraints had a derivative here and then an E here, and then there were further terms with R with a connection and an E, if I remember correctly. And an epsilon here. So we, in principle, we would have to quantize this constraint and try to solve it by putting the states equal to zero. But it's really awful because it's a complicated constraint. So we are not doing this. Infinitesimal version. Instead, we are considering, we will consider the gauge transformations generated by this constraint. And luckily, we discussed these, and we know the Gauss constraint generates gauge transformations. Unfortunately, so these are basically the lattice gauge transformations. And we discussed it in the classical part. And so what we actually will do is we will look for states which are invariant under these gauge transformations. And so these gauge transformations, they are just, it's really a change of frame. And so actually, we discussed that as we were discussing the transformation of the holonomy of an edge under gauge transformations. And so there we had the group element, which is associated to the final vertex of this edge. And then here you have the group elements minus one associated to the starting edge. And so here you see that. This is quite a straightforward action, and it's multiplying from the left and from the right with two different group elements, and so it's left and right translations. If you're confused by this minus one, it doesn't really matter because we can just put a minus one in our parameter for the left and right translations. But so here we see that basically the Gauss constraint generate these gauge transformations, which will be turned into left and right translations on the endpoint of the edges, depending on whether these vertices are actually the starting or final edge, final vertex of our edge. So this will be that, but so going back, how do we find states invariant under a gauge transformation? Under a gauge transformation, generated by a constraint. And so a simple example, and so the answer will be completely very obvious once we have it. And so as a simple example, we can consider the momentum, say, of conjugated to x1. And so you could consider, for instance, states x1, x2. And so you could consider x1 either to be an R, or another possibility is an S1. And so what, so if you consider this operator, let's call it T. Indeed. So T phi will do something which modulo sine is a translation. So don't ask me for the sine. it will do an x plus, it will do this translation of your state. And if you happen to be on the S1, it will be, this will be understood modulo this periodic identification. And so you're looking for a state which, now this physical state will be defined, since it's to be annihilated by C, to be left invariant by T. And so how do you get a state which is invariant under translations? You can integrate over translations, or you can integrate over R, or so it's all the same. So you could do this, for instance. So let's be a bit, let's put this into inverted commas, and let's write this ds. And so you know that this is fx1 plus s x2 ds, which if you change measure just means that if you have a gauge, if you have a group translation invariant measure, it just means that you integrate over your x1 variable. And so this is what we do, and so this is called a group averaging. Because you average over the group, over the gauge group of the stuff which is generated by your constraints. And so typically I told you the easiest example, the two easiest example which exist. So typically it's completely non-trivial to actually determine this measure, which is just given by ds here, because it has to be a measure which is invariant under this group, under this action. So the same as the Haar measure was had to be invariant under the fluxes. And so this is highly non-trivial, as you can imagine, in the case of 4D GR. And so it's not so easy to just do that. But for the gauge groups, at least you know that there is in principle this Haar measure for lattice gauge theories, which you could use. For non-compact gauge groups, it's already a bit more complicated. And here you already see also another thing, which is if you are an R, if you integrate out an R component, and you start with a state which is integrable here, so that means it has to be, an integrable state, and R is an L2 integrable state. It's never constant, because if you integrate a constant over R, you get infinity. So what you will get here as a result is a state which is not anymore in your so-called kinematic Hilbert space, which would be L2R tensor L2 some other R. And you would have to change your physical inner product, and you would just change it by dropping the integration over x1. On the other hand, if you are in S1, then a constant, you know, something constant in S1 is clearly integrable over S1. So in this case, you don't need to do anything. And so this actually just tells you that there's, for this x1 component, there's basically a unique solution in S1. You know, which would be basically a constant state, which is the physical state in S1. And so here the Gauss constraint, again, does SU2 transformations, which are also compact. So there's no need to change our physical inner product because we have a compact gauge group. Yeah.
One thing, when you make this group average, you're obtaining just one state, right? However, why would I expect that the gauge transformation generated by the constraint has a non-degenerate spectrum? It's the principle that can have a subspace that is left invariant by the.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it is highly non-degenerate. That's what you want. And here you can take any. Here you can take any psi. So, you know, so different psis may be projected onto the same physical state, but also they may not. So this is actually projection. So, I mean, so if you are, so if x1 is equal to s1, then this group averaging is a proper projection. And so here, this is a bit, you know, so this would be x1, x2. And so this means that you have a constant state in x1. But there's some non-trivial function in x2 left over. And so this would be the entire degeneracy in your spectrum, basically at zero. So I have given you an extremely simple answer, and but this, however, only applies to the simple examples. And the other simple example will be SU2 already. And of course, there's lots of literature where people consider more complicated examples, and you can get very different results. Okay. So let's close here and then continue tomorrow with actually applying this to the Gauss constraints. And then we go a bit deeper into this angular momentum recoupling. So then now we have all these angular momenta floating around, and then we need to couple them to something more coherent. Okay, so that will be tomorrow.